You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks and a very special episode as we head back to Saturday the 11th of December 2021 and Star Wars Family Fun Day. It's the day before farthest from, and I had the good fortune to sit down with three wonderful guests, the first of which was Guy Henry. You will know Guy as Grand Moff Tarkin from Rogue One. Rogue One celebrates its fifth anniversary this year, and the event was celebrating Rogue One. There were three guests. There was Guy, there was Neil Scanlon, there was Brian Herring. Those interviews are coming later to Panther Tracks, but right now, this is myself and Guy Henry sitting down at Star Wars Family Fun Day to talk Rogue One much, much more. And we're introduced on the stage by the one and only and my former co-host here on Making Tracks, Dave Tree. Enjoy.
Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mark and Guy to the stage, who are going to talk to you all about Rogue One. So can I have a big round of applause, please?
Masks off. What Dave doesn't tell you is he was 25 when that story happened. So welcome Guy.
Thank you.
Here in Fording Bridge, we're going to talk about a bit about Rogue One, a little bit about your wider career. I'm sure we'll go down all sorts of avenues.
Steady.
Yes. First things first, life. How is life treating you right now at this very moment?
Well, it's a rather deep question, isn't it, for a Saturday night? It's all right. Yes, we've just moved back to the New Forest where I was brought up. Went to Brockenhurst College, so that seems to be the arbiter of whether you are a proper local or not. You went to Brock, and I've spent 40 years away from the place and doing acting lark all over the shop. And a few weeks ago, we succeeded in moving back here. Whilst I'm still trying to finish off Holby City, which is the show I do where I pretend to be a doctor. So I'm knackered, but happy to be back home in the New Forest, I have to say.
I mean, obviously, the wider public will know you best, I would say, for Holby. How has it been now? You've been on that show, what, 11 years?
On and off, 11 years.
Yeah. How does it feel now that particular segment of your acting career is now drawing to a close?
Well, I think it's very much a mixed feeling, because the people you work with on that show are fantastic. I love the character I play. And on a purely mercenary sense, you know, as an actor, you don't get many opportunities to earn a regular wage. And many people don't, particularly in recent times. So I'm both excited by the idea of doing other things and very worried that I won't be able to afford the Brussels sprouts for next Christmas anyway. Because, you know, as I say, it's very, very unusual to get a regular wage like that, and also to enjoy the show. It's been a fantastic show, and one of the things I have loved about it is that if you are a guest actor on shows, you never get a chance to relax, really. You're in and out, and all the regulars are the guys who are doing the show all the time. So before I joined, I'd done a lot of that sort of stuff, and mainly theatre, in fact. And I think what Holby has given me is an ability to relax a bit more in front of the camera, and it's only when you're relaxed in front of the camera that you can do your best work. If you are a rabbit in headlights and your shoulders are up and you're frightened, you can't do your best work. So it's been a baptism of fire all day, every day for the last 11 years on and off. Not every day, but it's been a fantastic job, and I'm sad that it's finishing, but I'm excited about whatever may come along. I hope there is something, but you never know. I mean, I am tall and a funny shape, so I do tend to work. I've got lots of nice-looking, ordinary-shaped friends who are actors who don't work because there are so many of them. But if you're 6'4" and a bit strange, then you are likely to get roles.
I should be quizzing.
Yes, join the club.
Yeah. Before Rogue One, before we get to Rogue One, which is obviously the crux of what we're going to talk about, you were also in the Harry Potter series as well. How did that come about? Because to be involved in a tremendously successful series as that was, how does a role like that come across your sort of table, if you like?
I did a tiny part, a one-day part, for the director David Yates, who was directing a thing years ago called The Young Visitors, ERS, Young Visitors. It's a famous novel. Jim Broadbent was the star, and he was a very odd character, out of his depth in polite society. It's a very eccentric program, film, for television, and I played a one-off role as a sort of martinet etiquette teacher, and he was mad as a cut snake and vicious, and I did a lot of improvisation. You know, use your knife, your fork, your spoon, now, go on, but you know, all it was quite on the spot, on the day. And at the end of this quite frightening day of filming, the director David Yates said, thank you, you did very well today, and I will find you something else if I'd like to work with you again. And I thought, yes, you know, we heard that. And then a few years later, my secret agent rung up and said, they've offered you a part in Harry Potter. I said, and I didn't know the saga then. I knew of it, but I hadn't really watched it. So the agent said, but I said, well, what's the part like? He said, no, you don't understand. You don't have to go through the hoops. You don't have to do a screen test. You don't have to do all that frightening stuff. They have offered you the part. And that was David Yates. And he was as good as his word. Lovely man, terrific director. And it gave me the chance to be in one of the happiest and most delightful series of films ever. And so thank you, David.
Is a director saying, I'll have to find a part for you sometime, a bit like bumping into somebody in the pub saying, we'll have to go for a pint sometime? Is it one of those things that gets said and you think that's never going to pan out?
Doesn't get said that often, to me anyway. But when it does, as I say, you take it with a pinch of salt because people are happy with you on the day.
Yeah.
And they're pleased and you think, thank God, I didn't muck it up too badly. And you go home and you may never hear from them again. But David is a gentleman, actually. He had me, he was as good as his word. And he had me in the slightly odd film of Tarzan that he did. I don't know if you saw that one. Well, I was in that, along with various other quite well-known character actors. And unfortunately, our little strand of the story got cut. It was a sort of political side stuff, and it got cut out. And David had the grace to get his PA, because he's a very grand director, you know, and his PA rang up and said, have you got time to talk to David next Tuesday at 2:45? And I said, of course. And he said, I'm really sorry, nothing to do with you, but we're cutting you guys out of the film. It's not working, that strand. But you know, he's a nice man, and it goes a long way, I think, when you meet somebody as pleasant and courteous as that. Many people in showbiz are, but he's a real gent, yeah.
One of the things you said about working on Holby was that they gave you the latitude and the scope to go off and do other things.
Mm.
So other than Rogue One, which we will get to, what other things were you able to do during that Holby journey?
Well, I left Holby of my own volition after 3 years in 2013, and I went off and did all sorts of other things, including coach driving, which is my sort of great... I've always loved driving coaches, and I was, when I left Holby in 2013, I decided to take a coach driving test, and I worked for Westway of Wimbledon driving coaches. At the time, still recognisable from Holby and still recognisable a bit from Harry Potter, and hadn't done Rogue One then, and anyway, I looked like Peter Cushing. But I was driving my coach up Park Lane towards Hyde Park Corner, and I was right behind the back end of a double-decker bus, which was full of school children, and they were all pointing at me, and you know, saying, what are you doing driving a bus up Park Lane? Anyway, I was.
Fascinating.
But I left it for 2 years, and then, I'm talking about money, again, in a practical sense, I thought, well, I've been working, but I haven't been earning really anything like what I was doing before, and I asked to go back, so they said, all right then. And now they've sacked us all, and we are facing the last 5 days of filming this coming week, which is going to be very emotional, I think. Very lovely, lovely bunch of people, and a great show, and it's a shame they're cancelling it.
It is. I don't quite get it, but life is what life is. So we'll be seeing you in the revival of On the Buses then.
Yeah, on the buses, anything to do with coaches. In fact, I've got a slight dream of making us... We know that on Channel 5, they let sort of minor television-type people do, like me, and more famous than me, do sort of on-the-road documentary movies. We've had various people doing all sorts of funny things. And I'm determined that I might do one about the coaching industry then and now. And there's quite a few odd people, like Ken Bruce on Radio 2. He had a Route Master bus. And Charles Nove, it seems to be a radio people's thing. Charles Nove off Scala Radio, brilliant station, by the way. He's got buses and things. So I think it would be quite fun, because you get all sorts of loonies in the coach industry. Quite funny stories as well. I remember Westway of Wimbledon, one driver backed it with a coach full of school children. Doesn't normally happen, don't worry. And he backed into a branch of a tree and shattered the rear windscreen of the coach. And the boss of the company said, didn't you see the branch? Come on. And he said, I didn't even see the tree. So we're very safe on the road normally, though.
So we will get to Rogue One then. So
Rogue One.
Rogue One. So, Rogue One. There you go. So... Again.
The A1, a very good road.
I'm Gareth Edwards, and you're listening to Making Tracks on Fanthatrax Radio.
Obvious question, but how did that come to your door?
That again, I'm not sure, but apparently Gareth, who directed it, most of it, he was in a hotel room, and on came Holby City. And he thought, well, if anyone is going to have a go at Peter Cushing and Tarkin, that'll be him. So again, I didn't do any test or any audition or anything. And my agent rang up again and said, we can't tell you what it is. We don't really know. It's incredibly secret, deeply secret. You mustn't tell anyone that we can't tell you what it is. But you're going to meet this man at this... And they sent us to the most... Well, one of the most well-known media haunts ever. And there we were talking about this thing, supposedly in secret, with people listening to it. And actually, there were some people at the table behind who turned out to be Holby City fans, and they said nice things to me. So I said, carry on. I think the director thought I'd paid them to say, yeah, he's a good actor.
So when it was offered, when it was discussed, what did you know of... Well, generally of Star Wars, but also of that particular role.
Very little. I wasn't a Harry Potter buff. I didn't know very much about it, but I swiftly immersed myself in it. And my friend Geordie Scott Fraser, who's an actor, I met at the National Theatre when I was doing plays with him there. He's a great Star Wars fan, and he marshalled me in the direction of. I suppose it's not an exact impression of Peter Cushing. I wasn't capable of that, but I tried to get the flavour, the essence of the character and the voice. Although, as I've said to some people here earlier, I was deeply disappointed when the film came out, and quite a lot of my now ex-friends texted me and said, when they saw Tarkin, they said, oh yes, as soon as you opened his mouth, I knew it was you. So I thought, well, all those months and months of pretending to sound like Peter Cushing have been a bit wasted, haven't they? Because clearly I just sound like me. But no, it was. I'm proud of being a part of that, and proud of... I think it was a dubious... Some people thought it was a dubious thing to do, to recreate a person like that. But I think of it as a tribute to a wonderful actor, Peter Cushing.
Yeah.
That's the way I looked at it.
His family was certainly... seemed to be, the estate seemed to be certainly up for it.
They were, and... His secretary, Joyce, apparently was not young. I never met her, but she was taken. Obviously, she was with Peter Cushing for 25 years, and they were very close. And apparently she went to see the film, was taken by the... or shown the film by the studio or something, and apparently she burst into tears and said, he's back. Sir is back, she said, yeah. Which is rather lovely... And I'm glad that it didn't the portrayal didn't offend the people who matter.
The process, obviously, it was quite involved. What did you expect going into that? Was there any expectation of what you would be walking into? And
it was terrifying because, as I said, I'm not an impressionist, and you're conscious, even though I wasn't a Star Wars fan then, you're conscious of all the people who are and how much they care, and I didn't want to let Peter Cushing down either because I thought he was a lovely actor before I was ever involved with trying to pretend to be him. So it was very, very frightening. But there were various different possibilities. It started off with a wig I did with, you know, and heavy makeup, and I think it was always intended that it would be CGI. But it was also shot in a way in the end whereby they could take all that stuff out if it didn't really work and just have me.
Yeah.
I would have quite liked it if it had just been me, but then I think what they achieved was brilliant. So at the time, anyway, I mean, you said it's 5 years ago now, it's probably even more brilliant possibilities for that sort of CGI stuff now.
Yeah, it's held up fantastically well. They're in the kitchen at the moment, but me, Paul and Carl interviewed Gareth a few years ago, and he was quite clear that if it hadn't have worked out, the technology hadn't have been up for it, he was more than happy for it to be you doing that role. So clearly there was enough there.
Yes, well, it was a long-winded process because they rewrote a lot of it as they went along, and I kept thinking I'd finished, and then they'd bring me back and we'd do some more scenes, and it was an extraordinary adventure, I must say. And somehow, you know, to be in Harry Potter and Star Wars,
yeah.
I think I'd better do Star Trek next, and what other franchises do I have? Corner the market in nipping into a few franchises.
It's not a bad thing.
That would pay for the Brussels sprouts.
It would. So when you were on the set, the process, because it's take after take after take after take, how does that work? Because you've got Ireland guys there, you've got presumably the makeup people there, the director's doing what he's doing, you're trying to presumably focus on the performance. How much is going on when you're trying to get this down?
Well, funnily enough, I thought it would be more daunting than it was, but quite a lot of the crew were also people I knew from other jobs I'd done. Holby City. Some of the crew from Holby turned up, because people are essentially, as you know, are all freelance and they go wherever the work is. And if you're lucky enough to do shows like Harry Potter or Star Wars or indeed the BBC and Holby City, you do actually turn up. When you're as old as I am, you do turn up and meet people that you've worked with quite a few times. So that was encouraging. And they were very gracious and very nice. There was a lovely man, John, from ILM, whose idea I think it was to recreate Tarkin. And he was a fabulous chap. And he was always very encouraging. But you are, of course, aware of the weight on your shoulders, because that's quite an ask to pretend to be Tarkin again after all those years.
Yeah.
It's also quite a weight on your head, because that motion capture thing that you wear, I mean, Brian will know all about all these things, what it's like to be in you guys, what it's like to be encased in these things. You can't forget that you're acting with that great big thing on your head and the light shining in your eyes and things. But you can't moan. Great, great privilege to be in it.
How do you zone that out? Is there a skill in sort of pretending or imagining this contraption's not there and it's just me and the character?
And the other person, I mean, Ben Mendelsohn, who I did most of my scenes with, who played Director Krennic, a lovely man. He was very cross with me one day. He's a very methody actor, Ben, and he used to get himself frightfully worked up before each take. And I was being deliberately louche behind the camera to annoy him, and I succeeded beyond my wildest dreams, because he suddenly shouted at me before a take, "Don't look at the fucking monitor, guy, on the camera. Don't look at the..." And I wasn't actually looking at the monitor, as I told him afterwards. He said, "Oh, I owe you a public apology." I said, "No, you don't, Ben. It's fine. As long as you know I wasn't. But I was trying to annoy you, because that's the way you work best." He's a lovely man. So, you know, you just... There's a wonderful actor, the late Ian Charleston. I was doing a production of Hamlet with him. He was brilliant. I was Guildenstern, not too good. But... And I said to him one day, "But how do you get the Olivier Theatre audience to listen to what you're saying? you know, it's a long play. We could all get a bit bored. But it was, you could hear a pin drop. And he said, I just concentrate on what I'm saying. Which I suppose is what people do, isn't it? When you're talking, you're trying to get something over to somebody else. You're trying to persuade somebody of something. You're, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So you concentrate on what you're saying. Mind you, I used to forget what I was saying half the time because I was so frightened.
And they kept changing the script.
And they kept changing the script, yeah.
When you do a job like that, because as any actor, anybody in any profession, you're learning all the time, what do you think you took away from that particular job, if anything, you know, because it is so unique to itself, really?
I think, in a funny sort of a way, just what I've been saying, the fact that however outlandish it is, whatever you're wearing, basically, what you're just trying to portray a character, a person, or extraordinary monster, or whatever it is you're trying to do, that's what you're trying to fulfil.
Yeah.
And in that sense, every job is the same. That's what you're doing. Ever since time began, people have loved, human beings have loved sitting in the dark and being told a story. And that's what actors and people in the business, you guys, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah.
It's a lovely thing to do.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
You got a great reception from the Cushing family, obviously. You got a great reception from the fandom. How did that come across to you? Did you know that you'd done something that had really stuck the landing with the fandom, with the people that mattered?
Well, yes, because I've done some comic cons, some of them, with even more people in the room than this. And, you know, but so I've been all over the place.
Yeah.
And it was only really when I got to do some of the comic conventions and meet people all over the place that I realised the love, this, you know, the Generation
yeah.
Skywalker thing, the love and humour and passion that people have for the whole Star Wars saga. And again, it's like, you know, saying sitting in the dark and being told a story. That's what Star Wars does brilliantly, isn't it? I mean, that it is good versus evil, all the old-fashioned, time-old, time-honoured traits of storytelling are all in there.
Were you aware of that fandom as it is? Because Star Wars, we know, it's quite unique. You had no idea.
Again, of course I knew it was one of the biggest things that there's ever been in terms of public entertainment, but I didn't know how dear it was to people's hearts, no.
Yeah.
Not like that, no.
So has that been a pleasant surprise?
Oh, extremely pleasant. Yeah, lovely. It's very, very great to go and meet people who have such a passion for it. I did make a terrible error, though. There was a chap... I was doing a show like this in London, and he was saying something to me, and he was quite an eccentric guy, and I was slightly fascinated by his face, which was slightly eccentric, like a lot of us. And he handed me a beautiful original magazine from the New Hope, original magazine. And whilst talking to him and being interested by him, I unfortunately signed the character name from Harry Potter across his Star Wars, and he was, not surprisingly, slightly ballistic.
Right.
So the only thing we could do was offer him lots of free things, and, you know, and also I signed in big, very stylish big letters, and Governor Tarkin in Rogue One, so we calmed him down. But I was so embarrassed because it meant so much to him. It was a great thing of great value, and I bollocksed it up. So I was very sorry about that. But the affection and passion that people have for it is great.
Because obviously doing Holby for all that time, you're seen weekly on television, people recognise your face when round about, must be pleasant in the right circumstances. Is there ever any similar interaction with those fans? Because that's got a big following as well. Do you meet many of those?
Of what? Are the Holby
fans? Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Yes, yeah, lovely. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I mean, yes, It is nice. What's odd about being an actor, when I was very, very poor, I hadn't done very much, I could only afford 5 Rothman cigarettes and a very small courgette. I was in a little supermarket in Crouch End in North London, and I thought, I have got enough money, I think I've got enough to get some pasta. No, I had dried pasta in the cupboard. This is a bit of a violent story, but you know, this is anybody's life, really. You've got, you have your ups and your downs, don't you? This was a down. I've got some dried pasta in the cupboard. I can get maybe a courgette, and stupidly smoking, I'll get some... They used to sell 5 Rothman cigarettes in those days. Stupid thing to do, don't do it. And anyway, I said to the girl, here we are, and I proudly plonked quite a large courgette on the thing, and 5 Rothman cigarettes, I said, please. She said, no, you can't afford that. So I had the excitement of going back to the vegetable... I wasn't going to give up the cigarettes, so I went back to the... to the vegetable section and got the smallest courgette I could find, and that was, I was able to buy that with my 72p. So, you know, it's up to Christmas. And now it's all about vegetables with me. Yeah. What was the question?
Oh, I can't remember.
No.
So now you're doing visual effects work in stuff, Potter, not in the same way, but with effects around you, and then being very much the focus in Rogue One. I would assume that you're very open to, because obviously you've done television work, you've done movie work, you've done stage work, you've really done all of those different disciplines. You're happy to dip into any of them at any time?
Yes, I mean, it's very hard when you've been doing Holby for so long. Having moved house here, I quite like a little break, but I say that to recharge the batteries and see what comes along. I say that, and of course, again, I'll be worried that I'm not working. I'll be phoning this by, you know, next Friday, I'll be phoning the agent up and saying, has David Yates called at all from Harry Potter? But yeah, I don't know, we'll see. That's part of the excitement, is not knowing what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
As long as something does, then that'll be great.
Yeah. Is there anything on the wish list? Is there a role that evaded you that you think, oh, maybe I can circle back and snag that one?
Not on screen. I would have loved to have played. I think part of being an actor is you fool yourself. You know, you're hoping that you will be able to do this. I mean, I wanted to play Cyrano de Bergerac, great part, but I'm not right for it. I wanted to play Richard II, but I never did, which is just as well, because I think that's a very long-winded play, and I think the only person who enjoys Richard II is the man playing Richard II. He never stops talking all night, but. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't got anything. I wanted to do the play Shadowlands, right, which is about C.S. Lewis and his wife, and my friend Hugh Bonneville rudely did it at Chichester a couple of years ago, so that's probably on the back burner. Mind you, I could do it in a few years' time, couldn't I, and do it even better than he did.
Yes.
But no, nothing particularly, and you think you're tired of acting, you think you've done it for 40 odd years now, and then I'm a bit jaded, and I've done this, I want to rescue donkeys and have my dogs in the New Forest, and then I got this weird little job recently, another thing I did while Holby was on, funny little film, I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but it was a sort of sci-fi thing based on a time machine, which used to spin out from a vintage shop in Muswell Hill. It's called The Unreason. And I looked at the script, I thought, a bit odd. But I thought, well, let's have a change from Albert. Did it. I played a nice, eccentric science teacher, eccentric role, lots of improvisation. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it starred Johnny Vegas, the comedian, an actor who I have to say is bloody brilliant, delightful man. Sophie Thompson, again, delightful woman. And in one little job, I just did a few days on it, in one little job it reinvigorated my hopes for acting and my desire to do something new. So on to the next.
Yeah.
Sorry Holby's going, I've loved it, but
yeah.
You don't join the theatre to become a commuter, actually.
Yeah.
And it, you know, there's a day after day thing of driving to work, getting home, trying to get some sleep, driving back. I'm not, as I say, dissing it at all, no. But something new will be great.
Hi, this is Hugh Quashie. I've had great pleasure in recording this interview for Fan for Tracks.
Is your preference to work with established directors, or do you like working with new directors and sort of help in whatever way you maybe could, helping them learn their way, because it's, I would imagine it's two very different sets.
Yeah, that's a point I hadn't really thought about that. I have done a few student-y films just to as it were, you know, help the yeah. people along, and young directors' films, and they're always a hell of a mess and a pleasure.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
yeah, pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like being in the hands of if you pardon the expression, of a wonderful, experienced director.
Yeah.
That's we've got a great director doing the last episode of Holby, and he's done many, many of them. Lovely man. And the best directing is, you know, if you ask directions, if you're in a car, you know, people go, if you go up to the traffic lights, turn left. Of course, you've never listened, do you? You ask directions and then don't listen to a word they say. Pretty much the same with actors and directors. But anyway, directing is pointing the way.
Yeah.
And some people are good at it, and some people are less good at helping the actors, but they're perhaps good at helping the technical side of things more. And I don't know. Directing is a great skill, and not everyone has it.
Have you directed before?
No. Well, only a couple of. Well, I did when I was at the Royal Shakespeare Company. I did a play on The Fringe, and I directed it. And I'd always wanted this actor to be more human, less technically proficient, but more twinkly and human.
Yeah.
And I worked hard with him, and we got it like that. And then the first performance, he went straight back to what he would have done on day one, which is why another very famous director, Ian Judge, said to me, well, you know, I don't know why we bother to rehearse for all these weeks, because you will do what I employed you to do in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and you don't know what it is about you that might make you watchable. You don't actually know what it is you've done half the time.
Yeah.
You come off one night from the stage, for example, and you'll say, think to yourself, well, I was really menacing tonight, or I was very, and people will come off who've just seen you and say completely the opposite. So you saw, because what people see is a bit of a human being. They see something about the essence of
yeah.
a human being when you see the actor. No matter how technically proficient you are, you don't actually have any control over what the people sitting in the dark are getting from you. It's a strange thing.
That's a great point, because I suppose when you were cast for Tarkin in Rogue One, there's a physical similarity to Cushing. You're from a similar part of the world, so the voices aren't a million miles apart. But maybe Gareth saw, he's kind of quite charming in a way, and there's different elements to Tarkin, and maybe he yeah. saw something that you assumed he saw one thing, and maybe he saw yeah. another.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked to get it, and very flattered to get it, because as I said, if you've loved a an actor's work, to be asked to follow in his very large feet and his carpet slippers was amazing. But yes, you don't really know what it is that makes you watchable. Really, it's yeah. it's an odd alchemy, isn't it? Because we're all in it together, aren't we? You know, in the audience, when I go and see a play, I know that might be my friend Hugh Bonneville playing
yeah.
whoever,
yeah.
bastard. And you know, you think, oh. I'm pretending that you are who you say you are. You're pretending that it's a wonderful part of human human behaviour,
yeah.
isn't it? That
yeah.
we can all join in this storytelling thing together. It's rather nice. Strange, really.
When you play Tarkin, I'm asking because you said something yesterday, Jace, that made me think about it. Was there any point in filming your scenes as Tarkin where you wore slippers?
No, I'm sorry, I never wore the slippers. Peter Cushing was famous for having large feet, not being comfortable in the boots, diddly-dee, and asked Lucas if he could wear slippers, and he said, of course. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that we now look back on it as the beginning of an extraordinary adventure, the Star Wars A New Hope, that film. But of course, to them, it wasn't. It was they were just making a film, which I think a lot of them didn't even believe in, or you know, thought. And didn't they have to help out with the money? Didn't Alec Guinness put money in? I don't know. You know, it
took different points and
yeah, took different. Nobody could possibly have thought that we'd all be sitting in a hall in Fordingbridge, or I'd have gone to Florida, or wherever, you know, and be talking about it to this day. It's extraordinary. Brilliant. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Weird.
The long-lasting effect that one project can have over the course of...
Yeah, astonishing. You don't know, and you never know. You never set out to do... Say you're going to do a Shakespeare play. You never set out to say, right, let's do the most average, boring version of Two Gentlemen of Verona we possibly could. You always hope it's going to be the best. And anyone who makes anything, writes a book or paints something or does arts and crafts, whatever people do, you're always hoping it's going to be fantastic, aren't you? And sometimes it is.
Yes.
Sometimes. Yeah. So just, yeah, no, I mean, I didn't wear the slippers. I did, though, because I'm very tall, and we had a couple of Darth Vaders. One of them was Spencer Wilding, who some of you will know. Lovely bloke, again. He's a kickboxer from Rill. Very funny thing, which is cut from the film, I think, thank goodness, because he had to walk backwards, which is a very difficult thing to do with a cloak on, up a ramp. Well, he couldn't do that for love nor money. Very funny. But because I was no taller than... He was no taller than me, rather. I did have to... You know, I did play the scene like that. So no carpet slippers, but race or knees. Yeah, with the comedy legs.
It was a kickboxer from Real. Sounds like a Victoria Wood joke, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes. That's it. It's a great Victoria Wood joke about, you know, where you go to one of those naughty parties where you... you know, you put your keys in the bowl in the middle and see who, you know, you might get to meet during the course of the evening. And she said, I had no idea who got my moped, but I love that Peugeot. Anyway.
So, quick question just occurs to me. Obviously, you're in Potter, as we said. Have you done any Potter events, any Potter conventions? Are there many Potter conventions?
I don't think there are. Not in the same way that there are Star Wars ones, no.
No.
No. No, I don't. Not specific. No.
No.
I mean, obviously, people who come to the general shows are many are Potter fans.
Sure.
Quite right too. But no, not specifically.
No. Just curious. In types of roles going forward now that you would like to pull your experience together for, is comedy one that would ever attract you?
Oh, I've done a lot of comedy. Yes. I mean, look at me. Yes, comedy legs. Funny thing, I get on the theatre. I tend to get very outlandish, weird sort of fop roles, you know, and I'm comedic often. Whereas on screen, I tend to get the more saturnine and darker roles. I don't really know. I don't really understand what I do.
Is that horses for courses? Because sometimes, you know, the camera likes a certain thing, but the audience, when you're there, like here in the moment, it's a different avenue for putting that talent forward than it is on television.
Well, I'd like to have a go at doing... It would make a lovely change from Holby and lots of other filmy type things I've done to use my more eccentric, quirky, weird side to be funny on camera. I'd like to... Yeah, that would be... I mean, I've done the IT Crowd.
Of course, yeah.
But I was a rather serious, saturnine lawyer... in an episode saying, whereabouts on the bottom did he plant the kiss? A funny programme. I'd like to try moving my theatre sort of weird comedy stuff to the screen.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's just a bit too OTT, I don't know.
And if the opportunity to return to Star Wars ever came across your door, I'm assuming you would jump at it.
Oh God, yes. Yeah, of course, yes, I would. And now that I know that to many people it was an acceptable interpretation of that, what I quite like them to do, and that there are possibilities, I gather, but, you know, that they go back a bit further in time and they have me as Tarkin without the CGI, that would be lovely.
Brilliant. Well, I think we've covered every aspect of your career.
Yes. Oh no, far more.
Oh, is there more?
No. I've
got to ask now, how did this bus driving thing come about? Was that something you were into as a kid and it just...
Yeah, I just loved coaches. I don't know why, I've always loved that bus driving skill. It's weird, isn't it? I'm very strange. That's it. But I love it. Mind you, there's the actor's arrogance, because I thought... As I always admired the car, because I used to sit at the front of the London buses with the pretend steering wheel, you know, pretending to drive them. I've always loved driving. And so I took my test for the coaches, and I got a job in Wimbledon, as I said. And I thought that everybody on my coach would be amazed by my skills and virtually weeping with delight to be on my coach and asking for my autograph. Nobody takes a bloody bit of notice of you at all as a coach driver. You can stand at the entrance of the coach if it's, you know, you're greeting people to take them on a tour somewhere or whatever. No notice at all.
And did you cover a good area?
Oh, I went all over the shop, yes. I scraped two of them quite badly, yes. The bus company at Westford told me to go and pick up some very elderly Americans from the Playhouse Theatre.
Yeah.
And they said, you can park down that side. And then when I got there, I found you couldn't because they'd changed the yellow lines to red lines. Cannot go. So I was looking around for somewhere else to park. And I did the cardinal sin of I took my eye off the left-hand mirror. Yeah. And coaches, it was a big coach, and they're so large, you don't know what you're hitting, really. So it was about an hour and a half while I was doing like that. And I eventually looked in that mirror, and I saw this Volkswagen Charan going up and down like this. And there was this taxi driver going, no, stop, stop. But it took me minutes to realise I was slowly scraping along, so of course I got out and apologised. But it's a great skill hitting things in coaches. I'm good at it.
I can read that on the insurance report. I can just see it.
Yeah.
Any aspirations to learn to manoeuvre any of the large vehicles?
No. Coaches is it. I can scrape them to my heart's content.
I don't think we're going to top that. I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you. Go on, Henry. Thank you. We'll be back on later. Neil Scanlon's here later, so we'll be having a chat with Neil about 4 o'clock, hopefully, everything being equal. So enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks for listening to this very special episode of Making Tracks from Star Wars Family Fun Day. If you want to be part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit FanthaTracks.com or check out the free FanthaTracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at FanthaTracks. I'm sure to subscribe, leave a review on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Remember, tune in to our FanthaTracks new show, Good Morning Tatooine, live Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. UK, 4 p.m. Pacific, or 1 p.m. Eastern on Facebook and YouTube, and we'll catch you next time.